You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, it's been a rough year for all of us, but I just discovered a perfect little romantic comedy, a fable of sorts really, to help wrap up 2020 on a more cheerful and more hopeful note. John Patrick Shanley, who created the classic film Moonstruck, brings his sweeping romantic vision to Ireland with his latest movie, Wild Mountain Time. In the film, Emily Blunt stars as Rosemary, a headstrong young farmer who has her heart set on winning the love of her neighbor, Anthony. The problem is, Anthony, played by Jamie Dornan, seems to have inherited a family curse and remains oblivious to his beautiful admirer. And just to throw a fly in the ointment, Anthony's father, played by Christopher Walken, decides to deny him his birthright and sell the family farm to an American nephew. And wouldn't you know, that nephew, Madman's John Hamm, gives Anthony a romantic run for his money, setting his own sights on winning over Rosemary. This utterly charming movie opens in theaters and on video on demand Friday, December 11th, and today I'm happy to welcome John Hamm onto the podcast. He talks about visiting the Emerald Isle for the first time, filming in the ancestral hometown of President-elect Joe Biden, and why he was blissfully relieved that he didn't have to attempt an Irish accent. John recalls his childhood growing up in St. Louis, the unusual side job he had when he was starting out as a struggling actor, and the deadline he gave himself to make it in Hollywood. John discusses the lengthy audition process for the role that made him famous on AMC's Mad Men, the hardest part about hosting Saturday Night Live, and his plans for an upcoming reboot of the classic film franchise Fletch, coming up with John Hamm in just a moment. John Hamm is the Emmy and Golden Globe winning actor famous for his portrayal of Don Draper on AMC's Mad Men, as well as other memorable TV roles on Saturday Night Live, 30 Rock, Black Mirror, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Good Omens, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, just to name a few. On the big screen, his credits include The Day the Earth Stood Still, Million Dollar Arm, Bridesmaids, Beirut, The Town, and Baby Driver. Now he stars along with Emily Blunt, Jamie Dornan, and Christopher Walken in a new movie from John Patrick Shanley, the Oscar-winning writer-director behind Doubt. It's called Wild Mountain Time, and it comes out in theaters and on video on demand Friday, December 11th. John Hamm, welcome to the podcast.
Here I am.
Yes, here you are, and it's great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be had.
Well, John, before we get started here, we actually have a couple of mutual friends.
Who's that?
I mean, we have a lot of mutual friends, but we have a couple that I know of. In fact, they officiated my wedding. Randy and Jason Sklar, a.k.a. the Sklar Brothers.
Oh, yeah. They're my homeboys from St. Louis.
Right. Yeah, I know that you all originate from St. Louis. Did you know each other growing up?
No, we didn't. We didn't really know each other in St. Louis, although had circumstances been different, we would have ended up going to the same high school, but I ended up changing schools. So I met them out here, and then we got to know each other, and we're like, wait, you went to what high school? Like, wait, you grew up where? Like, oh my God, we were like neighbors. Like, that's insane.
Was there a rivalry?
Not at all.
Oh yeah.
No. Although they did, they grew up with a ton of kids that I went to like grade school with. So like I could, you know, mention all these people and they're like, oh my God, I knew him.
Tell me, is St. Louis a pretty good place to grow up? I've never actually been there, but I feel like I would like it. It's my kind of place. I've heard that they have pretty good jazz and blues scene, good barbecue. And I guess apparently there's something called St. Louis style pizza. Do you know anything about
that? I literally just had it last night. Emo's. It's very specific. You would hate it. you have to be born.
I would hate it.
Born there to get it.
Acquired taste.
Yeah, it's I was just in Detroit, and they have a version of their version of pizza is similar. But I it's a great place to grow up. It's a kind of has small town vibes, very neighborhood oriented. You know, a lot of sidewalks, a lot of yards. So I remember, you know, growing up was like spending time in, you know, if it was winter time, that was football season. So we would play snow football in somebody's yard, and we'd you know, if the pond froze over, we could play hockey. And if it was the summertime or springtime, we could play baseball in some empty lot or backyard or something, or wiffle ball or what have you. So it was just, you were very active all the time. And it was fun. You know, it was definitely fun. I remember growing up in the 70s as a little kid coming home from school on the bus. And then it was just like, okay, it's like kind of free play for 3 hours until your mom got home from work or, you know, the sun went down. And it was just this kind of loosely organized roving group of kids that would just find something fun to do.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty good place to grow up. So when did you decide to move out to LA and get serious about acting?
Well, it was after college. I had done, my dad died when I was 20. So I transferred schools and came home and transferred to the University of Missouri and started getting back into theater, which I'd done a little bit in high school. I got a scholarship. I just auditioned for a scholarship for the theater department and knew it was something that I kind of liked doing. And I dabbled in high school and middle school and thought, well, I don't know, maybe I could do this. Like I'm 20 or 19 years old, trying to 20 years old, figuring out what I'm doing. And, you know, it seemed like something to do. And the theater department and a lot of the teachers were very friendly and welcoming and seemed to think I had some talent at it and wanted to, you know, develop it. And so I did. And then I did about 15 plays in 2 years and did two sessions of summer repertory theater where just doing plays over and over again and got, you know, got some chops and learned how to do it. And then thought like, okay, well, in Missouri, you either go to Chicago or to New York or to LA to try to become a professional at this. And I didn't really want to go to Chicago. I didn't really know anybody up there. And I had some friends in New York, but I knew how I had no money and I knew it was so expensive and I had a car and I was like, well, I have a car. I could probably make LA work. And I have an aunt that lives out in LA. And so I have some family and I knew some friends. And so I thought, I guess I'm going to LA. And when I turned 25, I'd spent a couple of years after college back in St. Louis, you know, working in various jobs, waiting tables, you know, teaching, trying to make some money. And eventually I was like, okay, well, 25 years old, if I don't do this now, I'll probably never do it. And it seems like a nice round number, quarter century. Okay, let's go out and give it a shot. And so I did. And I gave myself about 5 years to try to figure out LA and figure out a job and figure out a career. And I made it. I made it right under the wire. So, yeah.
Yeah, I heard that you gave yourself that 30th birthday deadline, and I'd be interested to hear, what would you consider the moment that was your first break where you kind of said, okay, I can make a living at this whole acting thing? And how close to 30 were you at the time?
Pretty close. Mm-hmm. I got a couple jobs, and I got a couple gigs, and I ended up turning 30 on the set of a film called We Were Soldiers. And by that point I had been a regular on a TV show, or maybe I wasn't a regular yet, but I had worked fairly steadily and, on as a guest star on a TV show called Providence. And I remember turning 30 March of 2001 on the set of We Were Soldiers down in Columbus, Georgia. And, my girlfriend at the time flew several of my friends down to celebrate with me, and it was really cool. And we got to celebrate. And then over the course of that year, I ended up finishing the film by the summertime. And then later in the summer, I got my first, series regular job, which was awesome. And then I did 66 episodes of a show called The Division for Lifetime, and kind of never looked back. Yeah.
So I guess you kind of had the typical struggling actor experience at first, waiting tables and that sort of thing. But I also read, and I don't know if this is true, that you did some work as a set designer on porn films. Is that true? And if so, what is the hardest part of that job? Scotch guarding the furniture or what?
This story gets conflated about 45 million different ways. But
oh, really?
No, I wasn't a set designer. I worked in the art department as a set decorator, which is even weirder. But, and they weren't, you know, it wasn't porn. It wasn't hardcore porn. It was like this kind of Skinamax, you know, softcore sort of whatever those movies that, you know, surprisingly start coming on around midnight. It was something that I had no idea what I was doing. It was a job to make money. I made $100 a day working 12-hour days, which is probably illegal. I needed a job, and I did that for, I don't know, a month or so. And that was something to do. I mean, there's
got to do what you got to
do. There's all levels of this industry, that's for sure.
Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you at least one question about Mad Men. Is it true that you auditioned for that role of Don Draper something like 8 times?
Yeah, it took a while to get that part. I mean, that's the thing you kind of don't see often in is the, what the work that goes into landing a job, a lead especially, and especially a lead for what in success could be a job that might last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. There's a lot of people that have to sign off, and I was incredibly fortunate in that the main guy that had to sign off, who was the boss, he wanted me.
And Matt Weiner, right?
Yeah, Matthew. He wanted me, and he had to convince, you know, the rest of the executives that I was the right guy. And so it just took a long time. I re-auditioned. I did it. By the time we shot the pilot, I had performed at some point every scene in the pilot. And so I was prepared, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that was really the first scripted series AMC did. I mean, it paved the way for Breaking Bad, Walking Dead, all of that stuff. And I mean, it's one thing for you to have a great series to your credit, but you're probably the only actor who can actually say that he created an entire TV network.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. It was certainly their first. They were incredibly fortunate to they had a great follow-up with Breaking Bad, and then an even greater follow-up with Walking Dead. So, you know, they struck gold 3 times in a row, which is, you know, made their network, put them on the map, which is, you know, incredibly rare, obviously, but also incredibly great, and speaks to their foresight and vision. You know, Mad Men was a show that a lot of people turned down. They didn't think it was going to be successful, including HBO and Showtime, various other places. They just thought, nah. As was Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was, I think, originally an FX show, and they just thought, nah, I don't. This is too edgy. This is too weird. Like, people aren't going to be on board with this. But by the time both of them came around, the landscape had changed, and the way to tell stories had changed, and people were ready for these edgier stories with a little moral ambiguity, and they didn't need to be sort of spoon-fed the proper thing.
And that was still back in those days when the networks, they wouldn't even touch anything set in a different time. I think the only place doing period drama was HBO, but even those were few and far between back then.
Well, yeah, if anything, it was the periods were long ago, whether it was Rome or Deadwood or what have you. It was, and you're right, it was mostly the premium cable networks. This was a risk in a million different ways.
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom of television is like, never set a show in a thing where the stakes aren't life or death. And you put a show in an advertising agency, the stakes are, whoa, did you get the account? You know, who gives a shit?
That's a really good point.
It's not like, oh, we saved the patient or the guy got off from the death penalty or whatever. You know, it's like that was the traditional way of thinking, is that that's how you get people to not change the channel. And what Matthew proved is that you can also do it with a hell of a compelling story and characters that people want to spend an hour with.
Now, when you moved on from Mad Men, was it difficult at first to shake off the whole Don Draper thing in terms of the offers that you were getting? Did you read a lot of scripts for swaggery, brooding philanderers set in the 1960s?
I got a lot less of those by the time I finished the show. Yeah. When I first started the show, those were the things that I got. Everybody was like, you got to do this, you got to do this. And I was like, well, I kind of do that as my day job. And I made a very conscious decision to say, like, I want to do something else. And I was able to do Bridesmaids and 30 Rock and host SNL and really kind of pick more interesting parts and work with Ben on The Town and get to do kind of more just different things. And that's what I hope to be able to do. And by the time I finished the show, you know, 9 years after we started it, people recognized that I wasn't just a guy in a hat smoking a cigarette and I could do other things. So fortunately I get to do, you know, I get credibility kind of on both sides of the comedy drama aisle, and I get to do both.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. I've loved seeing you do comedy, like this new movie, Wild Mountain Time. I think you have a really a natural talent for comedy. I see it in your TV and film choices, on SNL, even on the podcasts that you go on, like Randy and Jason's show, Dumb People Town, or Comedy Bang Bang. Do you think comedy is your true love?
You know, I think performing is what I like to do. I think it's, again, like I say, I'm fortunate that people buy me in both arenas. There are some people that just, you know, when they're trying to be serious, you're just waiting for the punchline, you know, you're waiting for the, when's the joke coming? And I'm not necessarily that person, but I've always said that I don't think I'm funny necessarily, but I'm funny adjacent. So I can always be, you know, I'm smart enough to put myself next to funny people and bask in their glory. So that's not the worst place to be.
And your appearances on Saturday Night Live have been some of the best host sketches in recent memory, I think. I still laugh at Ham and Bubbly. In fact, my wife and I just watched it again last night.
Well, it's funny, like, I was in Detroit shooting this movie, and I went to the store to get some, like, you know, stuff for the kitchen, like soft drinks and whatnot. And they have that bubbly water called Bubbly.
Oh, yeah.
B-U-B-L-Y. And I remember that they had Michael Bublé was their pitch man, and he kept wanting to call it Bublé. And they're like, no, it's Bubbly. Michael, it's Bubbly. And he's like, no, no, no. And he kept changing the thing to an E with an accent on it. I was like, well, I feel like I had a little something to do with that.
Yeah, maybe so. And that's a perfect example of something that could have been a terrible sketch or a great sketch. Luckily, it was a great sketch. But, you know, we've all seen the bad SNL sketches where there's just one joke and it's usually a pun, and they just beat it to death over and over again for 3 or 4 minutes. But the way that you and Michael built on that joke and then just took it totally off the rails into some weirdly dark place was just genius.
Well, I will give all credit to one Seth Meyers who wrote that sketch.
Oh, really?
That was a piggyback on the original John Hamm's John Hamm, which was the ham you can eat in the toilet. Seth loves a pun and or some deft wordplay, and he's. I think there was one that never made it for the third time I hosted John Hamm's Ham Radio Hour or something. And I think we built the radio and then we were like, I don't think this works. So we wisely pulled the ripcord on that one.
Oh, what's the hardest part about doing SNL? I think you've hosted 3 times, right?
I did it 3 times. I hosted 3 times. I've been on it a bunch more times. It's really the pace. I don't know how that cast does it. Like, the pace is just relentless. And you're kind of constantly going on fumes, and it's New York City, and that has its own pace and its own demand for time and effort and everything else. And if you slip once, you fall so far behind, and then you've got to work three times as hard to catch up. And it's tricky, and it's unique. It's a unique experience in our industry. Like, there's just not a lot of people that get to do that. And I consider myself fortunate to have done it as many times as I have, but also to work on the two 30 Rock live shows, and like just to be able to be in that in 8H is a pretty jaw dropping experience. Yeah.
And by the way, you did a damn good James Mason impression too. That was one of the best James Mason impressions I've ever heard, I think. And also, I have to give mention to your role in the last season of Curb. I love that episode. You shadowing Larry David for a part, and then you gradually start becoming Larry.
Yeah.
I mean, only from the mind of Larry David. What's it like working with that guy?
Amazing. I mean, Larry's a great guy. He is as advertised. He's a wonderful man. He's a great dad. He's a good dude. And he's funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been watching a lot of the old Seinfelds, and you really can see Larry's, you know, comedic voice in that before you even mm-hmm. knew who he was. And you see a lot of the beats that come back in Curb where he's just, you can tell that's all Larry. And, the great hang. He's a wonderful guy, and I was super happy that he asked me to come be on the show, because I've loved the show since the inception.
And I love that for some reason, I don't know, this is never really explained, but every character on that show addresses you by your full name. It's like, well, hello, John Hamm. Would you like a Danish John Hamm?
Yeah, it is very weird. Like, it's so specific, but it makes me laugh. It just tickles me so much, especially Susie Essman. You get out of here, John Hamm.
Right. In fact, I think I'm just going to address you as John Hamm for the remainder of the interview here.
You wouldn't be the first.
So, John Hamm, you have this wonderful new movie, Wild Mountain Time, that opens this Friday. I thought it was just such a delightful film, I have to say, and such a great antidote to all the stress and the heartache of the past year. What attracted you to this role?
That, you know, it was the story is, as you say, is so earnest and beautiful and simple, and there's no cynicism or snark or anything. It's just a straightforward love story that wears its heart on its sleeve, and it's beautifully rendered. You know, it's John Patrick Shanley, who is one of our, you know, one of the best writers we got going on right now. And he took his play, he adapted it, he expanded it, and he set it in Ireland where it was meant to be, and he got to show this beautiful story. And you know, it's a very personal story for John. His father was born on a farm in Ireland, and he has roots that go very far back in Ireland, and he just got to tell this love story. And the you know, the theme of the thing is like, get out of your own way, you know, take a look at what you have around you and appreciate it, and don't take it for granted. And you know, we only get one shot at this crazy life, and you might as well enjoy it and appreciate it. And, you know, when you set that kind of a story and that kind of a love story and kind of a fable in one of the most beautiful places on earth, and you populate it with people like Jamie Dornan and Emily Blunt, you come up with a pretty compelling and a pretty lovely way to spend an hour and a half. And I hope people get to see this, and I really hope people enjoy it as much as I did, and enjoy it as much as we did making it.
Yeah, I absolutely adored this film. It's exactly the kind of movie that I want to finish 2020 with. Now, in Wild Mountain Time, you play a rich American who kind of becomes the fly in the ointment of the story. But I like how the character is written and how you play him, because it would have been so easy to make this outsider character the villain of the story. Was that something that you and the director, John Patrick Shanley, talked about?
No, that's just John's incredible storytelling. Like, he has no interest in making this guy a stock character of the ugly American, the villain. And part of it is because it's a surrogate, not only for the audience, but it's a surrogate for John himself, Shanley. You know, he's the outsider coming in who's not disdainful of this world. He's just mystified by it, because it's so different from what he knows. And like you said, he could easily become the antagonist in this story, but there's no real antagonist. The antagonist, if anything, is their unwillingness to kind of see what they have in front of them. And in many ways, Adam, my character, comes in and he's the catalyst. He's the person who gently sort of nudges indirectly these two people into their moment of grace. And it's really lovely. Like you said, it's the perfect movie to end 2020 with. We're just kind of like, let's end this on a hopeful note. Let's end this on a note where maybe there's something positive to be found. And
I'm curious, John, do you have any Irish in you? Ham, what is that?
I think somewhere down the line. Ham is very German.
Oh, okay, that would make sense. Yeah.
But I have some Locket in me, which I think might be Irish. I'm not sure. I did my 23andMe and it was like they sent me back a white sheet of paper. They were like, "This is what you are. You're just a white guy." I was like, "Okay." It's like English, German, Dutch, Irish. Oh, it's pretty white.
Yeah. This is sort of a weird question, John, but do you have any Jewish in you? Because for some reason, all the Johns that I know who are Jewish spell it J-O-N. And the WASPy Johns that I know, they all spell it J-O-H-N. And I don't know. Maybe it's totally a coincidence. I don't know why that is.
It's funny that you say that. I'm a Jonathan.
That's my
name is Jonathan. And one of my best friends out here in Los Angeles, my friend Tall John, to differentiate between me, Medium John, is that he spells his name J-O-N too. He's a Jonathan as well. So, and he's not Jewish. I'm not Jewish. I'm Catholic. And
okay. Are you a good Catholic?
No, I haven't gone to church in years.
Was this the first time that you've traveled to Ireland?
Yes.
Really? Beautiful place.
It was, I right off the plane and I was like, I want to go back tomorrow. If somebody snapped their fingers and the world turned normal again, I would get on a plane tomorrow.
Everything's a postcard there, isn't
it? I really wish I had more time. I worked the whole time and we were kind of in a fairly remote part of the western part of Ireland, but I would go back in a heartbeat I didn't really see Dublin. I didn't really see any of the big cities. I would just saw the countryside, but holy moly, you're right. Every angle is a postcard.
Didn't get to kiss the Blarney Stone, I guess.
No, I didn't get to do that, but I got to see a lot of the west coast of Ireland, which is craggy and rocky and just, it's spectacular.
Well, you're already a pretty eloquent guy, so I imagine that you don't need to kiss the Blarney Stone to get the gift of the gab. And it's in a weird location. They have to hang you over the side of this castle by your ankles in order to get to it. And me, I was like 7 or 8 years old when I did that, so it was just completely terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard it's a commitment.
Oh, yeah. Plus, someone once told me that I guess sometimes Irish folks get drunk at night and they go up there and, quote unquote, water the Blarney Stone.
Exactly.
So at this point, I'm pretty much convinced that the whole myth of kissing the Blarney Stone is just a prank that Irish folks play on tourists.
Oh, for sure.
So you filmed this where? In County Mayo, is that right?
County Mayo in two small towns in Mayo. One's called Ballina, which is the bigger of the two. And then the farm was in a small town called Crossmolonia. Which were, you know, picturesque little Irish villages. And Ballina, interestingly enough, is where Joe Biden's people come from. Uh-huh. They're having a good year.
Yeah, no kidding. Do they advertise that? Do they really milk it? Is there a Biden museum or a pub or something?
No, but where we stayed, the place we stayed, the kind of manor-turned-hotel, was where Biden had stayed. So they were very proud of that. There are pictures and stuff.
Did you get the Biden suite?
No, I did not.
No, your agent should have negotiated for the Biden room. Well, Wild Mountain Time is written and directed by John Patrick Shanley, as I said, who did, of course, Moonstruck, Joe versus the Volcano, and more recently, Doubt. Was this your first time working with him?
Yes, I had met him, and we had sort of flirted with working with one another on a play that I ended up not doing. But like I said, I had been a fan of his forever, and I've seen his plays. I try to see his plays in the original cast, and when going to a theater was a thing, I would love seeing his plays. Like I said, I saw Outside Mullingar, which was this, and I had a friend that was in Doubt and saw that when it first came out. And he's a good one, man.
Yeah, Shanley, he's no slouch. He's got a Pulitzer, a Tony, and an Oscar. And what about Christopher Walken? Talk about an icon. What was he like to work with?
You know, I didn't have a lot of scenes with him.
Okay.
But I did actually get to spend some time with him, and
oh yeah.
You know, he's such a interesting, lovely man. Like, he's just whenever I'm around people for whom I hold that sort of reverence, I generally keep my mouth shut and my ears and eyes open, and I listen more than I talk. And it makes that very worthwhile. He's super friendly. He's super shy. You know, he kind of is his own person. It was his first time in Ireland too, which I only recently found out. And John Patrick Shanley told the story where he was just so taken by the place. Like, you could tell he was just trying to absorb as much of it as he could. And John said he would just go back to, after they would wrap, he would go back to his, we stayed in these little kind of like bungalows on this property, and he would go back to his house and light a fire and just stare out the window at the cows and like imagine what the cows were doing. And I was like, well, that sounds like a Chris Walken thing to do.
Yeah, totally. And it really is as green as they say over there. That's not some kind of myth.
It's not a joke. I mean, it really isn't a joke. It sounds like a cliche, and it sounds like you're, you know, Lucky Charms in it, but kind of is true.
Now, I remember there was a little bit of a weird controversy when the first trailer for Wild Mountain Time came out. Some Irish folks didn't like the accents in the movie, and it sort of turned into a minor international affair. I mean, everyone from the National Leprechaun Museum, which apparently is a thing, to the Irish ambassador to the U.S. was weighing in on this. Are you glad that you didn't have to do an Irish accent?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. But the longer answer is that the Irish are never happier than when they're complaining about some sort of depiction of themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm using that. that's an indirect quote from John Shanley. But, you know, there's a tradition of the Irish complaining about depictions of the Irish that goes back to the early 20th century and the Playboy of the Western world. And, you know, it continues all the way through to Angela's Ashes and Far and Away and what have you. But, you know, it's when... The hilarious part of that whole quote unquote controversy was that it was based on the trailer. No one had seen the film.
Right, 1 minute you can't judge.
And also, I'm you know, I have quite a few friends that I made over while I was in Ireland. People that I've known before I visited, but they're all stoked to see the movie. they know that the story is lovely, and my favorite part of it is that they're ragging on Jamie Dornan, who is Irish. Like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty sure his accent's going to be okay. Like, he's one of your homeboys. Please all and you will please none. So I wish nothing but the best. I had the most exciting and fun time in Ireland, and I hope they enjoy the film.
Well, I thought the accents were great, but then I'm from Texas, so what the hell do I know?
Exactly.
Well, real quickly, before we go, I have to ask about what you're up to next. I've heard that you're working on reviving the Fletch franchise, and you and I are pretty much more or less the same age range. So I wonder, did you grow up on the old Chevy Chase movies like I did?
Yes, for sure. I loved that film. I was probably 13 or 14 when that movie came out, so I was... right in the demographic for it. And then I found out that there were like 11 books that Gregory MacDonald had written that I then immediately wanted to be like, I didn't know, like at that age, I didn't know that movies were based on books. I thought movies were movies and books were books. And that's how it goes. Like, people write movies. They don't write movies based on books. So when I found out that there were like 11 more books, I was like, there's going to be 11 more Fletches. This is going to be awesome. And then they made the sequel, and I was like, well, this wasn't nearly as good. Because that's how sequels were in the 80s. So when the opportunity came over the last few years of like, hey, would you want to like maybe try to redo this? I thought, yeah, like I read all those books. I know that there's way more stories, and they're all funny. But they're not, you know, Chevy had a very specific way of telling that story. It was very Chevy, you know, it's very physical comedy, and there's a lot of set pieces. It's very 80s, and it's awesome, and it's great. But we don't want to make that movie. There's already that movie. We're making kind of a little more of the book version of Fletch, which I'm sure people will be, you know, outraged by, but it is what it is. Like, it's like doing a cover version of a song, right? If you just want to sing it note for note, then you know, we already have the Beatles. Like, we don't need to redo the Beatles. If you're going to do it in your own way. So that's what we decided we would do or try to do. And we have Greg Mottola, who's going to direct it, who's not only a good friend of mine, but a hell of a director. And he's made some of the greatest comedies of the last, you know, decade or so. And he knows his way around it. And he loves the original. We're all coming from a very reverential place that we want to really do the source material its propers. So hopefully we'll make something that people like.
Yeah. I've never read the books myself, but I've heard that they're a lot less slapstick than the movie and kind of have more of a wry sense of humor.
Well, it's got a little more of an intellectual kind of bent to it. And it's less, you know, funny teeth and wigs and, you know, the thing. It's, there's still some of that, but it's less 80s and kind of egregious than all of that.
Man, that's going to be fun. I can't wait to see it.
Fingers crossed.
Well, again, Wild Mountain Time hits theaters and on video on demand Friday, December 11th. John Hamm, really enjoyed it. Thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again to John Hamm for coming on the show. Wild Mountain Time is available in theaters and on video on demand starting Friday, December 11th. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.